Welcome to a very special edition of We Talk Music. Once again, after a year layoff, we have Mark Kendall back on the show. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, man. We just played last night, played tonight. Really good crowd tonight. They were real into it. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, we were at the show, and I got to say that, you sounded amazing, and your tone was fantastic. So, you know, it was a very good show. Love it.
Thank you. Thank you.
So you guys look like you're having a lot of fun on there.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun on stage. Everybody was feeling pretty good. We got what we usually try to do if we got two in a row and there's a lot of travel. Get all the sleep you can the first night, because you're doomed after that. But we kind of just were all gelling tonight with everybody had a good spirit, good attitudes.
And the energy in the room was good,
Yeah.
It comes across. I mean, what do you see from the stage when you're looking out at us? What's it look like?
I like it when it feels like the crowd is right in the show, like you kind of pull them in and they're really, get their full attention and make them feel like they're almost on the stage with us. That's when I feel like we're kind of in the zone, Like, and I felt pretty good tonight. I really felt like we were engaging the crowd. I want to impress everybody. That's my goal, And I figure if I end up not impressing them, maybe at least they'll be entertained. But I hate making, a lot of people entertain people, but to impress them was a little more, it takes a little more energy, more effort. So that's I try to put my goal as high as possible because, we travel a lot, very far a lot of times, and so we want to make the most out of the time on the stage,
Well, this is the first time we've seen you with Terry singing.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, I was just listening to the live album from Sunset Strip, and I thought and it was good, but Terry blew me away today. He's really grown into the songs, I've found.
That was not, to tell you the truth, it wasn't a very good recording. We really didn't want to release it. And the Frontiers, we owed it to him from a long time ago. So kind of gave it to him. We weren't really that proud of it. I never said anything to anybody about that album. Because most of our live albums that we've done in the past always sound really good. They're done pro. This was kind of done non-pro. And like you said, Terry, it was very new. He hadn't done a ton of shows yet. Now he's really gelling. We're writing together all the time. And, I really learned his voice well. And I know his, where he's the strongest, it's those big blues riff, whatever, Glenn Hughes and that type of that blues thing, which is what I'm all about. That's why when you hear Great White, you're going, I sort of hear the blues in there, but like they got keyboards and they got, kind of rocks. And it's because when I go play by myself with some people, it's just straight ahead rock blues, man. But when you put all the guys and their influences and all that together, it just makes a certain sound. But you hear the blues in it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you really can't say we're, like Stevie Ray Vaughan, But it's really funny how when, and all bands have that, when you play together, it makes a certain sound. It's kind of a trip.
I was thinking that watching the show when you guys played House of Broken Love, I'm like, that's the song that kind of epitomizes the live sound of Great White to me.
Yeah.
Because it has that, it has all those elements.
Yeah, we got a documentary coming out, and Eddie Trunk kind of says that in the documentary. He says that, it's hard to consider them a hair band, even though they had hair. But I couldn't really call them the, quintessential hair band because they had that blues thing. And I always thought that was kind of different from all the other bands, because they had that kind of blues thing. But I've always told people that say, hair band just kind of, it's an easy out for a journalist just to call the whole decade a hair band. But if you dig into the songs a little more, you can see I told a journalist one time, my hair never wrote a song. You know what I mean? It's like in the 70s, bell bottoms were popular. Is that bell bottom music? You know what I mean? It really doesn't make sense. It was the fashion. Yeah, we had long hair. Yeah, the same guy that made Judas Priest clothes and Motley Crue's clothes made our clothes. You know what I mean? But it really didn't have a lot to do with the music we played, you know. And that's, you try to explain that to people, and it's hair music or hair metal, whatever. But it's all good, man.
Well, it's interesting because I noticed that you tour a lot with Slaughter.
And, yeah, we play a lot of shows with Slaughter.
Yeah, and even then, like, you still have a very different sound than Slaughter does. Like, Slaughter
right.
epitomizes a little more of that hair sound. So yeah. What is it that makes you tour with Slaughter? Is it just that they're really easy to fund to tour?
They're on our same agency, and it's one of the most requested packages from a lot of promoters. You know, next year it'll probably be, you know, we'll be doing some different stuff. For one thing, we're making a new album in January. We got this documentary coming out with a live show. So it's going to be like a CD, a second DVD that has like mostly show, but a lot of interviews about the songs. That way you can kind of break away and hear what the song's about, how it came about, how we wrote it, where we were, that kind of stuff. And then on the last disc, the last DVD, Blu-ray or whatever, it's going to be like all documentary with just a tad of live. So we really tell our whole story. We literally, these guys spent about 2 months following us with cameras, everything we did. I mean, we were on a tour bus or we were at a radio station, there was always cameras going. And the live show is very good quality. It had like 40 cameras, you know, cranes, and they got awards from their work with like Michael Jackson and Guns N' Roses. And so it's really done professionally. And plus we get a chance to tell our story. You know, because we never really had a chance to go back to where we were like teenagers, how things developed and bring you up to now. So I think it'll be fun for the fans because I'm a fan myself, and I know I want to know what Billy Gibbons, you know, what, were you 15? Did you grab a guitar? What happened? You know, how did you become this guy? You know, it'll give the fans a chance to get to know us better.
Well, that's one of the things that on our show we really like to do. We've talked to quite a few musicians, and we like to dig back and really tell that story. Because, you know, honestly, especially in the case of this music, sometimes, you know, like you say, the hair really becomes a barrier. And I think that there's so many interesting stories, and I love the fact that we get to tell these because they're awesome, you know.
You know, I mean, especially for, like, up-and-coming musicians, when they realize where we came from, it can help them realize that dreams really can happen if you're just dedicated and you believe it, you know. Because we used to literally pretend like we're doing interviews like I'm doing right now. We used to get with cassette players and go, so how did the band get together? Yeah. You know, oh, well, you know, we're hanging out. You know, and so all these things we pretended, we used to be in this living room and pretend like we were playing the Forum in L.A. That happened. You know what I mean? So it's when, you know, it's not always the demo tape, the 8x10 and the bio that get you a record deal. It always has everybody has their own story. It's usually a big accident. You know, the stars just lined up perfect or whatever. Because I know a lot of great musicians that haven't had the opportunities that we've had, you know, so that are great, great musicians.
Yeah, it's interesting because you were there at the beginning and I mean, you've had like two lives in essence, and so it's fantastic that you're able to come out. And you know, so how much work then are you going in? Because last time we talked was a year ago, and you were talking about the new doing a new album then,
right?
And now you're actually, you got Michael Wagner on board, and you're
right.
actually doing it. So
yeah,
I mean,
we're
that's
actually doing it. We have a date,
yeah,
January 3rd.
So, and he also with Michael Wagner, you know, producing it. I mean, you guys worked with him 30 years ago,
right?
and that was your first full-length album, and that's a totally different sound, right? I mean, that's a harder-edge sound.
And the reason it was a different sound is because we were kind of bandwagoning it. We were very, very young with our songwriting. Judas Priest was kind of a big deal, but flying under the radar like they weren't huge yet, and the Scorpions, and we were listening to that a lot. So the early part of our writing was just heavier, plus it was only one guitar.
Yeah.
It was just guitar, bass, and drums, which kind of changes things.
So I was actually wondering if that you were looking to work with him because you wanted to bring back a little heavier sound, but it sounds like it's just kind of...
There might be a little bit of that, but, you know, it's mainly the production-wise, you know, and having a fresh atmosphere because... You know, when you keep recording in the same studio all the time, you don't want to go through the motions, but when you know everything that's going to happen before it happens, it's hard to get, like, really excited, you know. But if we're going to Nashville, and it's a brand new studio, and we've never been there before, you know, we'll have more of that kid thing going on, like, yeah, man, this is badass, you know. So that, for, you know, in that regard... And plus, working with Michael Wagner, he's the funniest guy in the world. He's really, really good at what he does. And he's always trying to improve. He's inventing things all the time. He does workshops with engineers all over the world. And, you know, and he's excited to do it, which makes me feel really good. Plus, just hanging out with the guy is just amazing.
Can the city itself, not just the studio, but the actual city, kind of influence the sound of the album? Just because you're there and it's a
Nashville?
City, is it? Yeah.
I don't know. You know, I haven't really hung out in Nashville that much, but when I have been there, we've done amazing things. Like we did this annual benefit jam one year, and I met Mick Ronson. Steve Ray Vaughan was there. He signed a poster for me that I still have, laminated. He said, "Keep standing tall."
Awesome.
Steve Ray Vaughan.
I
got it laminated. But, you know, so that was a big musical experience with so many different, you know, Charlie Daniels in the same band. We played weird bills before, but that was, well, actually, we have blown that bill away before because we played with, one time with Black Sabbath, Buddy Guy, Slayer, and Bob Dylan.
Wow. Yeah,
all on the same stage, same day. It's like Dylan and Slayer. Are you serious?
I mean, could never see them getting together.
Well, in the U.S., for one thing, no promoter would take chances like that.
Yeah.
Having Dylan when Black Sabbath's playing. You know, they just don't do that. But in Europe, the audience doesn't care. They're just going just as nuts for Dylan as, you know, anything else. They might not be mosh pitting, but they're, you know, they're pretty much digging it.
Oh, that's awesome. What is the biggest difference between, like, recording this new album now and, say, recording 30 years ago, besides, you know, your age?
Well, we were green. I mean, we'd never done it before. I was real nervous and, you know... You know, everything was new for the first time, so, you know, you're excited, you know, you want to tell your friends how neat it is, and, you know, Michael Wagner, he didn't know the language, like, at all. He barely knew English, just a little bit, so he was real funny, and he didn't know about euphemisms. He didn't know about our soft language, how to say things like, you know, whatever, you know, like, if I'm playing my guitar... And he doesn't like it. He'll just say, "Don't play bad," or something. You know, I mean, he just doesn't know how to. He doesn't know. Hey, okay, I think you can get one better there, buddy. You know, he doesn't know all this stuff because he barely knows English at all. So that was funny. He'd answer the telephone. He'd say, "Telephone." You know, and he's so incredibly inventive. Like some of the stuff he's done, like with Accept. You know, the marching with the bolts and the box, you know, it sounded like 1,000 soldiers, the grinding of the teeth, you know, church bells made out of like tire irons and fishing line, and, you know, explosions coming from pinball machines, like he'd use that explosion for an explosion on the tape and just mic it. If he wanted a motorcycle, he would have a motorcycle drive by him, and he had mics all over. You know, we didn't have the internet back then, so he couldn't just pull shit, you know, off the internet. And he hated sound effects records. You like to make the sound.
Well, I mean, and that's better, isn't it? You know, like, I mean, to be able to kind of bring that stuff in organically is always going to be so much better, because it just, it impacts the way you feel about the music.
Sure, sure. You're not getting a pre-recorded sound effect. You're making it yourself. It makes it fun when it works. So
yeah.
It's fun. You got a story to tell.
You know, you guys, do you have any, I don't know, any covers that you're thinking of doing for this album? Because I just know when I look back in your catalog,
you know,
and you got
actually,
so many.
There was a couple that I was thinking might be cool. Whether we do it or not, you know, it's been thrown around, but I like that song Stuck in the Middle with You.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, do it, like, kind of our own way.
Oh, yeah. Stuck in the middle with you.
You know, and really blues it up, maybe rock it up a little bit. That was talked about. I don't know if it's going to happen. But,
you know, that'd be fantastic, because, I mean, you guys, through your whole catalog, really, you got so many covers that are in there, and you got, you know, songs that are well known, but you also got those gems that aren't as well known. I mean, obviously, the Ian Hunter, you know, is very.
The Ian Hunter song wasn't known at all.
No, not at the time.
Apart from in England, it was only not even really considered a hit. You know, it was just like a marginal known song. So the only reason we did that song is because we had an album called Once Bitten, and then this Twice Shy thing, and then Iggy Stradlin from Guns N' Roses played it for our manager. He goes, check this song out. It's called Once Bitten, Twice Shy. I mean, you should consider it. And he's like, it's on, man. This song's badass. You heard it, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And we just kind of did it our own way. It didn't even say, my, Once Bitten, Twice Shy. It said, I, yeah. Once Bitten, Twice Shy.
Yeah, I mean, so, Ian Hunter's amazing.
So that was kind of weird.
You know, he's...
The funny part of it is, we met Ian Hunter in 1984 when we were on tour with Priest.
Wow.
We borrowed his drum riser. our sound man was really good friends with Ian Hunter. Ian Hunter lived in New York. We needed a drum riser. He said he had one in his backyard. So we borrowed his drum riser. Then in 87, or I think it was 87 or 88, we played with Guns N' Roses at the Ritz in New York. And he came to the show. He used our bus for a taxi cab. I mean, we were riding around with Ian Hunter. This is way before we did his song. And then, by coincidence, this song shows up, and it's Ian Hunter. We'd already been with him two times. So
first
it was
time
really
you hear
neat.
The riff in that song, what goes through your head? You mean that?
Well, for one thing,
so
I thought it was a good, solid song, but by no means, you know, like my manager says, by no means did we know it was going to take on a life of its own, you know. And I didn't even know if they were going to make it our first single. I was thinking, like, maybe Lady Red Light or some other song. But the record company goes, no way. This is the song right here. And then it just, it almost dwarfed the band. I remember, you know how songs are like that? They become so big, you don't even know who does it. You know, I mean, there's so many songs like, you know, Spirit in the Sky. You could ask 20 people here who did Spirit in the Sky. Spirit in the Sky.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Nobody will know. But, you know, yeah, it just went crazy. But before that, when we had our first big hit ever, it was almost 8 minutes. And actually, Niven, they interviewed him for this documentary, and he has it wrong. I wasn't worried about that song being the single. I was worried because it was so long.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost 8 minutes. And I'm just thinking, you know, like, we're not Phil Collins, who this isn't our 27th hit. We'd never had a hit before. So to throw an 8-minute song at a radio station, I was just paranoid. So what Niven did, he put 3 minutes and 59 seconds on every song. And no one got it. No one got it. No one knew it was 3:59. And by the time they figured it out, it was too late. The song was huge. You know? So that was pretty funny.
Well, there's this article that we read today, actually, where Alan Niven explains it as, like, every DJ wanted a chance to go and go to the bathroom and phone their girlfriend
right,
and stuff.
Right.
So it was totally cool to have, like, you know, basically 2 4-minute tracks put
Niven's
together
really
as well.
Brilliant, yeah. And that's what he said. Yeah, it's like, now you get a chance to go to the bathroom and, you know, go get a drink or whatever. Yeah, exactly. You know, I don't know how they sold it, but, you know, this song, if you listen to it, even back then, it does not seem 8 minutes or whatever.
Oh, no, it doesn't.
There's so many dynamics in it, you never say, God, you know, like, when's this song going to end, or, you know what I mean? Because it keeps taking you down here, and then back up here, to, you know. So it doesn't seem like a super long song, but, man, it just goes on and on.
Well, I've noticed that even with quite a few of your songs, like Mr. Bone is fairly long, you know. There's a lot of, like, 6 minute, you know, long 5, 6, 7 minute songs, but they don't feel like that.
Yeah, Alan was a big fan of kind of long endings, some jamming and stuff. So he was not afraid for us to do, you know, he really shaped us. You know, he was our extra pair of ears, and you know, the guy was a genius, man. I mean, he took Guns N' Roses from way down here mm-hmm. up here. You know, now he didn't really do a lot with our music, but I think he had a lot to do with their just personal development and their edge and all that kind of stuff. Amazing stuff.
Do you ever take a song that's, you know, on an album like that, like I don't know, She Only, for instance, which ends with a guitar solo that's, you know, a couple minutes long, and I always thought that was good. I couldn't believe it wasn't a single, honestly. I thought that was going to be a home run single.
Yeah,
and I thought, you know, like a concert, like, you could stretch that out to 20 minutes and just keep going because it's just so beautiful. Do you ever do something like that? You just take it?
I'm such a fan of melodies like that because when I was a little boy, I used to listen to music a lot, and I just would listen to the singing. I always sang along with the singer and just fell in love with these melodies, and I would just sing those melodies. I just loved them. So when I became a guitar player, I go, well, these singers get to do all this cool stuff. Why can't I do it on my guitar? Mm-hmm. And that's why I think I play the way I do, because I want it to be memorable. I want it to be a melody type thing, not just, you know what I mean? I want it to have some kind of, you know, just memory. You know, like guys like Jimmy Page, I think part of their, what's going on?
Just, you know.
Chilling?
Yeah, and having fun. It was a great show.
Right on. Thanks, buddy.
It was a great show.
You too, man.
Thanks.
You're awesome. There you go.
So, yeah, I was always kind of a fan. You know,
a little cameo
of solos that you remember like 20 years later, you know, like Stairway to Heaven or something. You know.
She only is that type of solo for me, you know.
Right on. Thanks, man.
That's awesome. You. What's that like when you get that riff, you know, you're fooling around, you're coming up with something, you get that, like Mr. Bone, you just get that riff and you just know it's good. You know, like, you just, what's that feel like?
Well, you can kind of feel that it's melting into the song, and it feels like it's the right thing to do. And I play along with it until I can tell, you know, and then I'll usually get a pretty cool melody, you know, because of the changes. That has a lot to do. If the changes are nice, like if I write a song, I know there's a lot of available melody. I usually have one in my head, a singer melody. And I also think about, I want it to be kind of sweet underneath as far as the chord changes. That way you can come up with a lot of really nice melodies and stuff to put over it.
What's the difference then? What do you make, what takes somebody from being a good guitarist to a great guitarist?
I think a good guitar player just plays very clean, has a great technique or whatever. A great one can play with just unbelievable feel like a Carlos Santana, to me he's great because he feels all those notes, and he also knows, he uses any kind of speed or anything for a dynamic.
Yeah.
Not because he just wants to show off and show how fast he can go. You know, he does it for a reason. So I think that separates, you know, obviously there's guitar players that are just wizards at playing incredibly fast or technically like geniuses, but they can't grab a note and just squeeze it because that's how they're feeling at that moment, you know. So there has to be some kind of soul connected to your instrument. I fell in love when I was 14. I literally played only Santana because I saw him squeeze this note and hold it for like almost a minute. And I couldn't figure, I go, how can he do that? Like, you know, feel that way at that moment. Like, it just squeeze it like it's for his life or something, you know. That's great to me. That's great, you know.
I actually felt the same way when I saw B.B. King the first time. It was just, you watch him and the connection that he had with the guitar is just unbelievable. And Santana is exactly the same.
They feel all that stuff, you know. It's nothing that can be on paper. They might not do it the same way tomorrow night, but it, you know what I mean. And Stevie Ray Vaughan had it too. Believe me, he had that. Yeah, that kind of separates. You know, there's technically great. Like, I can never do this stuff this guitar player, this awesome musician can do, but I might be able to express more feeling than him. You know what I mean? But that doesn't make me better. It's just, I don't know. You know, I like a guy that has all the schooling maybe that this guy has, but has the feel of Stevie Ray Vaughan, you know, or Carlos Santana. But that's hard to come by.
Well, it's like you've got to learn the rules before you can kind of break the rules. But, you know, learning how to emote, I you probably can't teach that.
Everybody in my family can read music well. My dad could sight read like a Mo, you know, jazz trumpet player. He's conducted like orchestra. Well, in high school, my grandpa and him, you know, wrote all the music out for all these instruments, these people playing. These big like orchestras and stuff. So he was really schooled. But what he did with me, he didn't force the sight reading on me. He just said you should get your shit together and like, you know, do it. But what he was concerned with was, can I play with a metronome? He used to set up one of those wooden ones.
Yep.
Chick, 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 chick. He goes, play something. And I go, well, I don't know what to play. You just play anything, play anything. Play to that, you know? And so I did, and I was keeping the groove. He goes, all right, you might do okay. He tells me I'm only as good as my drummer.
Yeah, you need that drummer to keep a good time, that's for sure.
I got to ask you about this, because I've always wondered, we've been following your career for, you know, your whole career pretty much. We've always listened. The Recovery Live album cover. Right. You guys, with your guitar, you're taking it, jamming it, and somebody dressed up like nurses.
Here's the funny thing about that. We were just tinkering around. We had free studio time. I mean, we owned the studio. We could do anything we wanted there. Alan Niven went to England for like 3 weeks doing something. I don't even know what it was. And we just went in, we were just playing cover songs, just for the hell of it. Not even intending to release it. And just did all these covers that, you know, did some stuff Jack wanted to do, like, No Matter What You Know. You know, he likes stuff like that, like that Beatles, which I found out McCartney wrote that song. I go, I always thought that sounded like the Beatles.
Yeah.
But it was Badfinger.
Oh, okay.
That's, it sounds like the Beatles.
That's crazy.
But McCartney wrote it. That's why. Yeah. And I go, I could totally envision,
About the old gray wall. Da, 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 da. Nothing to say, nothing to do, nothing to do. That's so Beatles.
It is.
And sure enough, Paul McCartney wrote that. So, you know, we just did all kinds of off the wall cover songs, and Niven heard him. He goes, let's put that out. Yeah. Like the Zeppelin thing sat around for I don't even know how long. We went out and did those. Because when we did that Zeppelin song years ago for MTVs, fans just tortured us to play Zeppelin. They wanted us to, after we did that one song. So one year we just gave it to them. We just, let's do all Zeppelin. Let's just do all Zeppelin. You know, who cares? We can do whatever we want, you know. But we made it challenging. Instead of doing the stuff we did in the backyards when we were 16 or whatever, like rock and roll and all the standard, we did stuff we'd never done before. You know, like In the Light, Ramble On, Stairway to Heaven. Oh, my God. Every guitar player in the world thinks they know Stairway to Heaven, including me, until I went to learn it. I go, I've never played this song correctly. You know, maybe that, you know, the beginning.
Yes.
Just to be cool at the party. But I never knew it. When I went to learn that song, man, it was way different than what I thought.
That was actually one of the first songs that I ever tried to learn on the guitar.
Yeah.
So I was crazy.
Yeah, it's really super cool arrangement on that. Yeah, Page. When you go to learn Jimmy Page, it was actually really challenging and fun because a lot of times there was like three guitar parts.
Mm-hmm.
So you just kind of pick the two most dominant ones and we play those guitar parts. But the way he orchestrated guitars, that's part of his genius, is in the studio. So he played on so many records along, you know, before Zeppelin or whatever, as a session guy, that he really learned the recording process and how to orchestrate guitar parts. And man, he sure did it good.
That's awesome. We don't want to take too much of your time here tonight, so
enjoyed it.
I mean, we got a million questions, but we talk about those obscure covers. Like, how is it that you get find those more obscure songs? Like the Angels, you got two songs from them,
right?
You know, you got Billy Joe White and guys like that maybe aren't necessarily so well known. So how do those come to you?
That all came from Niven because he knew those guys really well, and actually he managed them. They had a couple songs, and they just could not break in the States. It's like the audience just wrote them off as an AC/DC wannabe.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it was really sad because I thought their stuff went a lot deeper.
Just
because
they're from Australia, too?
Their songwriting. Take Me Away to Monsaine. That was a great, great song. They did another album like years later, something about the world going round. I don't even know. Nobody even heard that record. And, you know, Alan managed them, had them out. They were playing gigs in Hollywood like the Palace, which is a pretty big, nice little 1,500-seater. And, you know, they did a show. I don't know why, man. But that Doc Neeson, he died, you know, a couple of years ago, but he was kind of a genius in a way. Like, he really wrote good. It was a great band. But we just kind of did it because it kind of fit what we do. And these songs were being wasted because they weren't being accepted in the States. And we figured maybe if we do them, people would dig it for whatever, you know, because we had already established ourselves. So the fans, the part of the problem with them is they got written off as the AC/DC thing. So the songs never really got the opportunity, you know, to be accepted, to where we were kind of more established. So we do a song, people might listen to it a little more. Maybe we do it because we had such a great singer and you know, the way we deliver a song, I don't know. It just sounds like us more than maybe some, even the guy that wrote it. It sounds like him, you know. So, whatever.
When you're playing Can't Shake It tonight, that's kind of, you know, I'm like, this, you guys have made this your own.
Yeah.
But it was terrific. It was terrific. Yeah. It was a great performance.
And, you know, like that breakdown thing, that happened by accident one night. We really liked what happened on that part, you know, when Terry kind of breaks it down and says, you know, mm-hmm. can you feel it? And can you feel the love?
Oh, totally.
And all that, you know, that happened by accident when I, because Terry loves to jam and so do I. And if we're feeling like we want to jam during a song, we just go for it. And it don't always work out, but when it does, we go, let's do that. Let's let's make that part of the set, you know?
Well, that was one of my favorite elements of tonight was when Terry broke it up, especially the intro to Mr. Bone. You know, fantastic.
Yeah, just and that was a complete jam. I just rattled that off one night. And we do it a little different each night.
That's awesome.
Which makes it exciting for us because, you know, on those segments, we really don't totally know exactly what's going to happen. You know, it's hopefully as it works out, you know.
And there was a lot of subtle stuff with Terry that we thought, geez, you know, like, it's great that he's not a Jack Russell clone, you know,
right.
that he doesn't sound like him.
We could have got one mm-hmm. that just do every lick exactly. But, yeah, we wanted to expand a little bit and not get just the exact same thing. You know, because that way you're turning the page. I mean, when Deep Purple got Coverdale and Glenn Hughes in the band, he wasn't they weren't Ian Gillan, you know
no,
what I mean?
That's right.
They had a different vibe going on, and they made a great record. My plan is this next record to be amazing. We're not going to settle for any songs that aren't just awesome. At least in our mind. But, you know, I mean, whether people like them or not. But I want to really be satisfied with this record, production-wise, songwriting-wise, and everything. And I'm really pumped about doing it. But remember the song, the album Burn? I mean, wasn't it every song?
It was smoking. You know?
Completely killer. I want to have my burn.
Yeah. No, awesome. That's fantastic. Well, Mark, we totally appreciate it. Thank you for
being
on. Hopefully you'll come on again once the new album's released.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.